Coon Review, Print Speaking to the Blind, celebrating 40 years of audio newspaper production. Welcome to this week's edition of the Herald Scotland podcast, recorded at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre by our amazing volunteers. You can get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter or Instagram using @CoonReview, that is @CUEANDREVIEW. You can also contact us directly by emailing information@coonreview.com. That is information @CUEANDREVIEW.com. Or by calling 0141 772 3976. That's 0141 772 3976.
The Herald Scotland, on Wednesday the 22nd of November 2023. From the news section. Angus floods. Farmers to get grants of up to £30,000. An article written by Jodie Harrison and read by me, Connie. Farmers hit by severe flooding in Scotland this autumn will be eligible to apply for grants of up to £30,000 to help repair man-made flood banks. The Scottish Government said farmers in local authority areas worst affected by flooding after recent storms will be able to apply for the funding. The areas included in the scheme are Moray, Perth, Kinross, Aberdeenshire, City of Aberdeen, Angus and Fife. The scheme will open for applications next month and be administrated by the Scottish Government. Rural Affairs Secretary Mary Gugin is expected to provide details of the new funding when she addresses an event at Agri Scot, which will take place at the Royal Highland Centre on Wednesday. She said ahead of her speech, "I've seen firsthand the devastating impacts that flooding had on our rural communities from storm events last month. Those same communities continue to deal with the after effects to this day. Repairing damaged flood banks is a crucial step to safeguarding rural communities and land from any future extreme weather events. That is why we are providing £1.8 million in support to help ease the financial burden on farmers affected by floods." That article was from the Herald Scotland. It was written by Jodie Harrison and it was read by me, Corey. The Herald, on Wednesday the 22nd of November 2023. From the news section. Edinburgh Park Arena. Plans for 8,000 capacity stadium. An article written by Jenny Sanderson and read by me, Corey. The group behind the O2 Arena have announced plans for a world-class 8,500 capacity venue in Edinburgh. AEG Entertainment hopes to transform land at Edinburgh Park into an indoor area for live music and entertainment, which will cement the capital's reputation as a destination for culture and global tourism. The plot earmarked for development is scrubland 70 metres east of One Lochside Court in the South Gyle area of the city, next to the Edinburgh Park Premier Inn and Edinburgh Park Rail and Tram Station. Giant US architecture firm HOK is on board for the designs, according to Architecture Forum Edinburgh SSC. Alex Hill, President and CEO of AEG Europe, told The Scotsman, "AEG is thrilled to announce this spectacular new arena for Edinburgh. Its location with immense potential, amplified by Parabola's transformative development and regeneration of Edinburgh Park. The much-needed 8,500 capacity arena will bring world-class live music and entertainment to Edinburgh, further cementing its reputation as a destination for culture and global tourism. We look forward to this development becoming an integral part of the local community and complementing one of the best cities in the world for the arts and live entertainment. Reacting to the news, Council Leader Cammy Day said, "Great to see plans for an Edinburgh Arena at Edinburgh Park. Great opportunity for Edinburgh. Looking forward to consultation and plans being submitted." The preliminary application, which can be seen on the Edinburgh Council website, relates to land which has already existing consent for an apart hotel, retail, office space and cinema. Alongside the arena, the proposal includes hot food and bar amenities, new access, parking and infrastructure development at the site. Public consultations into the plans will be held on December 4th and January 9th of 2024, from 3 p.m. until 7 p.m. at 1 New Park Square. There have been long-awaited plans for an indoor arena for Edinburgh for some time. In December of 2019, plans were unveiled for an 8,000-capacity venue on a site at Stretton. By contrast, Murrayfield Stadium has a capacity of 67,000 people, while Hampden Park can accommodate 51,000 people. That article was from the Herald Scotland. It was written by Ginny Sanderson, and it was read by me, Corey.
Herald Scotland recorded on Wednesday, 22nd of November, 2023. Arts and Entertainments. Jenny Colgan's Midnight at the Christmas Bookshop is a feel-good novel by Alistair Mabbitt. Midnight at the Christmas Bookshop. Jenny Colgan. Sphere. £14.99. Barring an appearance from Santa Claus himself, which would be cheating, there can't be many new releases with as much festive spirit as this sequel to Colgan's 2021 bestseller, The Christmas Bookshop. Picking up where its predecessor left off, it continues the story of Carmen, who works in a good old-fashioned bookshop in Edinburgh's picturesque Victoria Street, trying to keep her unworldly boss, Mr. McCready's, ailing business afloat, while the city's sky-high rents keep her stuck living with her sister's family. The shop's future is under threat from Philistine businessman Jackson McLaugherty, who's determined to take it over and turn it into yet another purveyor of tartan tat. What's more, Mr. McCready has dropped the bombshell that he intends to join an Antarctic expedition and is considering selling the business to the dastardly McLaugherty to fund it. The battle is on, once again, to save this bibliophile's paradise from extinction. It wouldn't be a Jenny Colgan novel without romance, which arrives in the shape of Brazilian postgrad Oki. But the lapsed Quaker makes no sexual moves in Carmen because he believes that sex is a spiritual connection not to be taken lightly. His inability to communicate that to Carmen when she runs out of patience and flings herself at him in sexy lingerie leaves her feeling spurned. Amid the confusion, Oki accepts a place on an expedition to the Amazon, and when he's left incommunicado, Carmen assumes it's all over between them. They're both rather functional plot threads, but they come wrapped in what must be one of the most effusive love letters to Edinburgh ever written. Colgan clearly adores the crenellated gothic splendour of the old town, its dark closes, its stacked layers of history, its hidden subterranean mysteries. And she loves it most of all at Christmas when cosy golden auras of light and joy and comfort penetrate the icy darkness. Even Oki, back in balmy Brazil, waxes nostalgic for the chill of easterly winds swooping down the long rows of steps that made you shiver and pull your clothes around you and cram your hat further on your head, looking forward to getting in out of the wind to a cosy bar or a warm library or even just the Scotmid supermarket. Above and beyond the romance of Edinburgh at Christmas, there's a magical quality to the shop itself. The shadowy stack gives the impression of stretching deep into the volcanic rock, perhaps forever, and the interior dimensions of McCready's adjoining house, which extends upward into the lawn market, confound even Carmen. Having written 6 Doctor Who novels, Colgan knows the imaginative power of a space that's bigger than it appears on the outside. Fittingly, both Christmas Bookshop novels have been launched at the existing John Kay's Bookshop on Victoria Street, but there's an aura of self-mythologising about the whole endeavour, perhaps the hope that one day the series might gather enough momentum to bring into being a permanent Christmas bookshop,
like 221B Baker Street or Platform 9 and 3 quarters at King's Cross, Colgan shows a degree of self-awareness when a film crew uses the shot to shoot scenes for a terrible Netflix movie, sentimentalising it with fake snow and kids dressed as Dickensian and urchins. But the rest of the time she plays it completely unironically, in a wide-eyed celebration of true love, her favourite city, Christmas and the joy of books. By Alistair Mabbitt, Herald Scotland, recorded on Wednesday, 22nd of November, 2023. Arts and Entertainments. Nintendo, how getting lost in the Highlands led to a new video game. Exclusive by Craig Williams, reporter. A new video game is inviting people to embark on an outdoor adventure through the Scottish Highlands and uncover its secrets and stories along the way. A Highland Song is a narrative adventure game which tells the story of a teenager named Moira McKinnon, who has 7 days to cross the Highlands to reach her Uncle Hamish's lighthouse by the sea in time for a magical surprise that awaits. Developed by award-winning UK-based indie-developed Inkle, A Highland Song is described as a part survival adventure, part platformer, and part rhythm game, with a surprising, sprawling story that weaves into every decision you make. The 2.5D side-scrolling adventure brings the Highlands to life with a blend of hand-drawn animation, impressionistic painted scenery, and dynamic lighting stroke weather effects. Described as rhythmically adventurous, players climb peaks and crisscross glens in time to a soundtrack composed by multi-award-winning Scottish folk bands Talisk and Fourth Moon. Ahead of its release on the Nintendo Switch console on December 5, the game's creative director Joe Humphrey revealed that the game is unlike anything that Inkle has made before and was inspired by his own adventures in the Highlands as a youth. He told the Herald, "I grew up in Fife, and I had an amazing school teacher who used to take the kids up to the Highlands to go camping and go hill walking at the weekends, and I absolutely loved the experience. In fact, the survival elements of the game were inspired by foolish exploits as a teenager going up into the Highlands with my friends. There was one particular occasion when we got very lost and had to be rescued by a deer stalker, and he drove us up over multiple hills in the Highlands almost to our start point. It was getting really late and really dark, and we had to find our way back down the mountain in the pitch black, stumbling through bogs, not being sure whether we would find our way back, but obviously we did make it back in the end. It did have quite a strong impact on me." Joe conceded that Inkle haven't replicated all of the Cairngorms and Glencoe or everything, with the narrative adventure instead taking place in a kind of fictionalised version of the Highlands. He added, "It's their own kind of fictional take on it, so that we can construct it in a way that suits the structure of the game. But broadly speaking, it's trying to capture the feeling of the foothills north of Dundee and going up high into the Highlands, and then coming down more towards the Western Isles and the West Coast. So you get that kind of different types of scenery that you'd seen in the Scottish Highlands. It features a lot of climbing, exploration and survival. One of the core kinds of crescendos or high points in the game are these set pieces where you run in time to a modern take on Scottish folk music, where the landscape basically forms itself around the rhythm of the music, so you have to jump in time to the music." Speaking of the soundtrack, Joe, who's been living south of the border since he started university, said it was partly born out of feeling a bit homesick alongside the discovery of modern Scottish folk bands, such as Talisk. He said, "As a kid I had the experience of doing Scottish country dancing and stuff at school, which I hated, along with that old-fashioned style Scottish country music. I was completely unaware that there's this kind of modern version that's young and energetic and has got incredible rhythms, but also that it's still harking back to kind of more traditional music. It's got that incredible tone to go with it that suits the theme of the game perfectly. I personally got massively into that genre of music once I discovered it, and I thought that blend of the Highlands and the imagery that I fell in love with as a child, mixed with this incredible music genre, would be fantastic when they work together." The first Inkle game to feature a jump button, Joe feels A Highland Song might have a broader appeal for people who like more traditional game mechanics, as opposed to the pure narrative-based mechanics that previous games Inkle has developed. Although he appreciates the game might have an increased appeal with those who may have ties to Scotland, he believes A Highland Song will have a wider appeal than just to Scottish people. He said, "Obviously there's the connection with Scotland that's going to be great for Scots or British people, as well as a certain American audience that ties back to Scotland and look at Scotland in a fond way. But we're not aiming to sell the game based on its Scottish roots necessarily. I think it evokes a really beautiful tone, but you don't have to be super into Scotland to enjoy that. A Highland Song launches Nintendo Switch on December 5 by Craig Williams.
This is from the Herald Scotland on Thursday the 23rd of November 2023 from the news section. Angus floods. Farmers to get grants of up to £30,000. This article is written by Jodie Harrison. Farmers hit by severe flooding in Scotland this autumn will be eligible to apply for grants of up to £30,000 to help repair man-made flood banks. The Scottish Government said farmers in local authority areas worst affected by flooding after recent storms will be able to apply for this funding. The areas included in the scheme are Moray, Perth and Kinross, Aberdeenshire, City of Aberdeen, Angus and Fife. The scheme will open for applications next month and be administered by the Scottish Government. Rural Affairs Secretary Mari Gujung is expected to provide details of the new funding when she addresses an event at AgriScot, which will take place at the Royal Highland Centre on Wednesday. She said ahead of her speech, "I've seen firsthand the devastating impacts that flooding had on our rural communities from storm events last month. Those same communities continue to deal with the after effects to this day. Repairing damaged flood banks is a crucial step to safeguarding rural communities and land from any further extreme weather events. And that is why we're providing £1.8 million in support to help ease the financial burden on farmers affected by floods." That article was written by Jodie Harrison. This is from the Herald Scotland on Thursday the 23rd of November 2023 from the news section. First bus strike called off in Glasgow after new pay offer. This article is written by Katrina Stewart. Planned strike action by drivers working for Glasgow's main bus company has now been suspended as union members consider a new pay offer from the company. First bus drivers were due to walk out on Friday for 7 days of industrial action that would have included 1,200 drivers. Unite, the union, has now halted the action after a new deal was tabled, stopping what would have been extensive travel disruption across the city. Planned industrial action between Friday, November the 24th and Friday, December the 1st has been cancelled. A spokesperson for First Bus Scotland said the company appreciated the situation would have caused uncertainty for passengers and apologised for this. He said, "Following further talks with union representatives, we can confirm a new offer will be put forward to union members for ballot by Unite with unanimous recommendation of acceptance. We appreciate the uncertainty this will have caused our customers and employees and wish to thank them for their patience while the discussions took place. All first bus services across Greater Glasgow will operate as planned." That article was written by Katrina Stewart. This is from the Herald Scotland on Thursday the 23rd of November 2023 from the news section. Israeli oil firm highlights plans for Shetland developments. This article is written by Mark Williamson. North Sea heavyweight Ithaca Energy has underlined its confidence in the potential of the Cambo and Rosebank finds off Shetland after making huge profits in recent months. The Israeli-owned firm said it was actively engaging with firms that might buy into the Cambo field, although it has faced challenges in its efforts to finalise plans to develop the find. Ithaca's former partner in the proposed development, Shell, shelved plans for the project after they sparked fierce opposition from environmentalists. Ithaca acquired Shell's stake in a deal it said yesterday involved limited near-term cost. Executive Chairman Gilad Myerson said Ithaca had enjoyed a quarter of strong and strategic progress and continued financial delivery in the 3 months to September 30th. He was speaking as the company disclosed that it made $1.37 billion, that's £1.1 billion, profit in the first 9 months of the year. That compared with $1.44 billion in the same period last year. Ithaca's confidence in the prospects for Cambo has probably been boosted by the fact that the Norwegian major Equinor decided in September to proceed with plans to develop the huge Rosebank find off Shetland. Ithaca has a 20% stake at Rosebank. In a results statement issued yesterday, Mr. Myerson said, "The decision to progress with Phase 1 of the Rosebank development alongside Equinor represents a significant milestone for Ithaca as we continue to deliver against our buy, build and boost strategy." The company bought a 40% stake in the Falkler discovery in July with a view to bringing the field into production in 2026. In the results announcement, Ithaca noted the progress it has made to increase production from North Sea assets acquired from other firms, such as the Captain field. Ithaca acquired a stake in Captain with a $2 billion portfolio it bought from America's Chevron in 2019. Another big North Sea player, Neptune Energy, has highlighted the value of a field it brought into production this month off Scotland, soon after accepting a multi-billion dollar takeover bid that underlined the appeal of the area to overseas investors. Neptune said the start of production from the Seagull field east of Aberdeen, with BP, is expected to help it achieve a material increase in production in the current quarter. This will allow Neptune to capitalise on the increase in oil and gas prices seen in recent weeks, amid moves by Saudi Arabia to support the market. The start-up of Seagull came 5 months after Neptune agreed to an offer from Italian oil and gas giant Eni that valued the group at $4.9 billion, that's £4 billion. The deal could pave the way for bumper payouts to the investors that supported the firm's push for rapid growth in the North Sea. These include US private equity firm Carlyle and state-owned China Investment Corporation. Eni's decision to buy Neptune indicated it saw growth potential in a business which became a significant force in the industry, helped by acquisitions in the North Sea. Neptune acquired its interest in the 50-million-barrel Seagull find from US giant Apache in 2018. Neptune is assessing the potential of the Isabella find made off Scotland in 2020, with Total Energies of France and Ithaca Energy. The group also has operations in countries ranging from Norway to Indonesia. It made $536 million third quarter operating profit against $887 million last time. Neptune's UK business made $28.8 million, down from $42.9 million. Oil and gas prices have fallen from highs reached last year amid Russia's war on Ukraine. Uncertainty about the outlook for the global economy has weighed on sentiment. However, Neptune's production remains very profitable. The company received an average $62.50 per barrel oil equivalent for its output in the third quarter. Production costs averaged 12.7 barrel oil equivalent. Neptune noted, oil realizations strengthened in the third quarter as oil markets tightened as a result of OPEC production costs. Regarding European gas markets, the company added, Q3 saw multiple event-driven price spikes, with Norwegian outages and potential strike action in Australia resulting in short-term rallies. That article was written by Mark Williamson. This is from the Herald Scotland, on Thursday the 23rd of November 2023, from the news section. Ivan McKee, NHS Scotland needs to adapt to increase productivity. This article is written by Jodie Harrison. Red tape and bureaucracy in the NHS is hampering attempts to drive down record waiting lists in Scotland, a former government minister has said. Writing in the Herald, Ivan McKee said that a lack of communication and cohesion between the country's 14 health boards has led to resistance to innovation. Mr. McKee also believes that Scotland's vibrant tech sector is being ignored, with more new processes exported than adopted at home. There are currently more than 700,000 people on NHS waiting lists across Scotland, the highest total ever. The former business minister said that advances in technology such as AI and robotic surgery could vastly improve productivity. He said, Scotland benefits from a vibrant life sciences sector, with new technology being developed by innovative Scottish startups and spin-out businesses from our world-leading university sector. Yet so much of that great Scottish technology finds itself being exported only, rather than tackling waiting lists at home. Scotland's healthcare system has so much opportunity for improvement in this area. 14 different health boards, all potentially suffering from not invented here syndrome, needing to go through their own individual processes before adopting technology that has already been proven to work elsewhere. The MSP added, and resistance to innovation at a more local level too, with little incentive to adopt latest technology or process improvements. Mr. McKee accused health bosses of pilotitis, where innovative projects are trialled but not taken up en masse or rolled out across the country. Arguing for a cut in NHS bureaucracy, he said, what is necessary is an unwavering commitment to the fundamental principles of our NHS, a recognition that more bureaucracy is almost never the answer, a prioritisation of spend on cost-effective prevention and frontline services, a willingness to innovate at scale and at pace to make the best use of Scotland's technological and research excellence to benefit patients, and a need to overcome inertia when it comes to getting different parts of the complex health and social care system to align and work together. This can be done, but might require us to think differently about how we do it. That article was written by Jodie Harrison.
This article is from the Herald on Thursday, the 23rd of November, 2023. It is from the opinion section, and the headline is, How Many of Us Would Sunak Have Been Happy to See Die? And the writer is Neil Mackay. Empathy is a much derided concept these days. In the age of thin-skinned political strongmen and culture warriors who believe destroying an opponent means winning an argument. Poor old empathy is so put upon, we forget it's a two-way street. Empathy isn't just about thinking yourself into the shoes of someone less fortunate or someone who's suffering. Empathy is also about thinking yourself into the Bond Street loafers or Dior slingbacks of the rich and powerful. What would you do if you were in control? How would you act if you could influence the world? That notion is the nucleus of Good Samaritan laws all around the planet. If you, fit and healthy with a mobile in your pocket, see someone dying in the gutter, you're required to ring an ambulance. Belgium enshrines it best. Failure to help a person in danger is a crime, unless helping that person also puts you in danger. There's something repellent, isn't there, to human nature, either the mind or perhaps the soul, if you're so inclined, about the strong feeling to offer assistance to those in peril. To have the power to help but then shrug your shoulders surely debases everything that's good about our poor, weak species. Clearly, some believe the opposite. Some consider life to be a Darwinian knife fight, a scramble for survival, where I've every right to put my boot on your head and push you under, kicking my way to the top. The books of Ayn Rand, a terrible writer and a failure as a human being, still sell among the ranks of hardline conservatives in Britain and America. Read her execrable novel Atlas Shrugged for a vision of that barren hell where all are pitted against each other. Or you could save yourself the agony and recall how Thomas Hobbes describes this state of nature, this war of all against all, in his book Leviathan. In such conditions, he famously said, our lives become solitary, poor, nasty, brutish and short. As a vaguely despondent optimist, I'm aware of the contradiction in terms, but isn't modern life a contradiction in terms, so I'm happy to move with the times. I believe there are more Good Samaritans in this country than there are Ayn Rands. I believe most of us are empathetic, and if we can, we'll be kind. If that's true, if most of us are made of the stuff that would reach out to help those in danger, how must we as a nation respond to the current British government? How must we respond to a Prime Minister, a multimillionaire Prime Minister, who believed the government should just let people die during a pandemic? For that's what we've learned from the UK COVID inquiry. That fact, dark and hard, void of decency and humanity, came in a diary entry for the government's former Chief Scientific Advisor, Sir Patrick Vallance. Boris Johnson was for letting it all rip, while his advisor Dominic Cummings was arguing we need to save lives. Vallance wrote, DC Dominic Cummings says, Rishi thinks, just let people die and that's okay. Just let people die and that's okay? Savour that phrase a moment. Swill it around, like a glass of good champagne at a number 10 lockdown party. How's it taste? How's the mouth feel? Has it got a good nose? Slip down well? We also learned Johnson said that those who died had a good innings. Perhaps we should write that on 231,692 headstones across Britain. Here lies my dead mum. She had a good innings. In memory of a much-loved grandpa, he had a good innings. R.I.P. my wife, my husband, my father, my granny, my daughter, my son, my auntie, my uncle. They all had a bloody good innings. It's disgraceful enough to learn of the bumbling, shambling, anti-science idiocy of the Tory government during pandemic, of its venal corruption, its clunking, dull greed, its boastful public schoolboy arrogance. But to see, to hear, to watch the proof laid out before us that these people didn't give a damn whether we lived or died goes far beyond corruption and failure, far beyond the notion of a government out of its depth. This is malice towards the people. This is sociopathy. This should be criminal. How many people would the Tories have been happy to see die? What number would have mattered to them? Half a million? A million? 2 million? All of us, except them? I seldom use words like monster or evil. Once they are deployed, there's nowhere else to go. You've consigned an individual to a category marked the worst of us. But I've no other language with which to decorate the souls of Rishi Sunak, Boris Johnson, and the men and women who collaborated with them and did not stop them. These people are not fit to clean sewers. They should not be in power. Indeed, we should be frightened for our lives that they are in power. The UK COVID inquiry doesn't have the authority to recommend criminal prosecutions. However, that doesn't mean criminal prosecutions shouldn't follow in its wake. If there's a case of corporate manslaughter to answer by those who had their hands on the levers of power at the moment of greatest threat this nation has faced in decades, then let justice run its course. Evidently, the same goes for the Scottish Government, any damn government. Citizens are human beings, and human beings are not counters on an abacus. We are not here to be subjected to the whims of millionaires who feed off us. If this doesn't fill you with rage, I've no idea what will. Those without anger must be conditioned to their destruction. Live a slave, die a slave. By way of an ending, let's return to Ayn Rand. She'd sneered at and tormented the principle of state intervention and welfare her entire adult life. In her final years, she died a lonely old woman, dependent upon Social Security and Medicare. As the dark closed in and her philosophy floundered, perhaps you imagine she changed her ways. At her funeral, there was a floral arrangement in the shape of a dollar sign. even death cannot destroy cruelty, selfishness and greed. That article was written by Neil Mackay. This letter is from the Herald on Thursday, the 23rd of November, 2023. It is from the Voices section and the headline is Politics Without Principle, and the writer is Alan Carmichael from Glasgow. In 1925, Frederick Donaldson at Westminster Abbey gave a sermon and said, "The seven social sins are wealth without work, pleasure without conscience, knowledge without character, commerce without morality, science without humanity, worship without sacrifice, and politics without principle." Dr. Gerald Edwards suggests Scotland could reopen to a brighter future if we close Holyrood and put our faith in Westminster. Really? That letter was submitted by Alan Carmichael, Glasgow.
This is from the Herald Scotland on Friday, the 24th of November, 2023. From the news section, EIS teacher report reveals scale of violence in Scottish schools. Exclusive by James McEnany. An annual survey of Scottish teachers has laid bare the levels of violence and aggression in the nation's schools. Scotland's largest teaching union, the EIS, carried out a detailed survey of teachers' experiences. The subsequent report, which runs to more than 100 pages, paints a stark picture of unacceptable behaviour and under-resourcing across the country. The survey was distributed to all EIS school branches in Scotland, with 875 responses received by the set deadline. This represents around a third of the 2,461 schools in Scotland. A total of 63.2% of respondents said that there are daily incidents of pupil-on-teacher violence or aggression in their school. The figures were higher in primary schools, 63.7%, than secondary schools, 56.9%, but highest in special schools, 90.4%. A further 19.5% reported that such incidents happen on a weekly basis, while 5.1% said they occur monthly. Just 11.6% said that incidents occur only rarely. Respondents were also clear that incidents of violence and aggression are now more common than they were 4 years ago. A total of 88% said that incidents have increased in that period, with the majority of those reporting that the increase had been significant. Physical violence against teachers was the most common type of incident reported by primary schools, 85.1%, and special schools, 86.5%, but was highlighted by just 5% of secondary schools, where the use of intimidatory, obscene, or derogatory language towards teachers was the most commonly reported issue. Verbal threats and physical intimidation towards teachers were also highlighted as a problem in more than half of schools. Union members were also asked whether prejudice-based incidents, such as those driven by racism, sexism, sectarianism, or anti-LGBTQ attitudes, had increased over the past 4 years. 46.9% said there had been no change, but 23.6% said that incidents had increased slightly, while 15.8% reported that they had increased significantly. Survey responses also revealed that teachers face violence and aggression from parents and carers on a regular basis. Half of schools reported verbal threats to teachers, while nearly two-thirds highlighted intimidatory, obscene or derogatory comments aimed at teachers. A similar proportion said that teachers have been subject to intimidatory, threatening or derogatory emails, phone calls, messages or letters. Social media was also identified as a source of such comments by half of schools. Most seriously, 34.4% of schools reported that teachers had been subject to physically intimidatory or aggressive behaviour from parents or carers, and 4.7% said that issue had escalated to physical violence. More than half of schools reported that such incidents happen weekly, 12%, monthly, 17.4%, or termly, 23.9%.
The statistics also suggest that incidents of pupil-on-pupil violence and aggression are common in schools, with just 6.3% of respondents saying that they rarely happen, while 74.4% said they happen on a daily basis. In terms of frequency, 61.9% said that such incidents have increased significantly over the past 4 years, and a further 22.7% said that they have increased slightly. More than half of schools also reported that prejudice-based violence and aggression between pupils has increased. The survey also sought teachers' views on the causes of violent and aggressive incidents, with the overwhelming majority stating that unmet additional support needs are exacerbating the problem. This was considered to be the case in 96.3% of primary, 89.1% of secondaries, and 92.3% of special schools. A clear majority, 62.4%, also identified this as a contributory factor with regards to violence and aggressive behaviour from parents and carers. A range of possible policies to support pupils and teachers in dealing with violent and aggressive behaviour was also presented to teachers. A total of 75.5% of primary, 67.3% of secondary, and 65.4% of special school responses backed increased support staff for pupils with additional support needs. More than half of respondents from all sectors also believed that reduced class sizes could help to address the problem of violence and aggression in schools, with most support found amongst secondary teachers, 72.8%. Other common suggestions for improvement included better access to educational psychologists and support services such as CAHMS, C-A-H-M-S, greater support from outside agencies such as social work, increased teacher numbers, and better policies and procedures at both school and council level. Commenting on the results of the survey, EIS General Secretary Andrea Bradley said, "We all want our schools to be nurturing, welcoming places where pupils can learn and staff can work in a safe and secure environment. Sadly, the evidence from this major national survey of EIS branches reveals that violence and aggression is a serious and growing problem in schools across Scotland. This must be treated seriously and tackled quickly by the Scottish Government and local authorities to ensure that school pupils and staff can feel safe and be safe in our schools. The EIS will be sharing the results of this survey with the Scottish Government and with each of Scotland's local authorities, together with our recommendations which set out a roadmap towards a better future for our schools. Our young people and all those working in our schools have the right to expect action to address the challenges identified in our report. Put simply, education shouldn't hurt." That report was by James McInerney.
The Herald on the 24th of November and the letters of the day. Westminster must share Ferries blame. It sometimes seems that, like death and taxis, frustration with the problems that beset Scotland's ferry services will always be with us, on our letters page at any rate. Earlier this week, a reader expressed his dismay at the news that Caledonian Brain's contract for the West Coast Lines was likely to be renewed without going out to tender. That in turn prompted a spirited defence of CalMac by a resident of Rossi, saying that the real villain is the Scottish Government. Today, however, a correspondent argues that Westminster needs to share the blame. Ian Cope of Glasgow writes, "John Ferguson is correct to draw some of the fire from CalMac. I come from Rossi, I remember how unfair some of the criticism was. However, to then simply blame the Scottish Government is to stick one's head in the sand and ignore the fiscal situation, whereby the Scottish Government was set up to be so dependent on Westminster that it cannot deviate much from the UK mean. As I have mentioned before, the amount of wealth the Scotland assets have delivered to the UK has been vast. Why do we still have second-rate infrastructure, including the ferries and ports? I submit that most of this wealth has ended up in the pockets of multinationals, in redundancy payments to the workers whose industries were destroyed in the last 50 years, and in world-class infrastructure. For London, the ports and ferries, among much else, have been crumbling for decades, and they are simply not the fiscal tools for any government Scottish Government to do much about it. At least they usually try, and the ordering of 6 new ferries, 2 in Scotland and 4 in Turkey, is something, if only a sticking plaster. If the 2 ferries in Port Glasgow had been delivered on time and on budget, it would still be nowhere near solving the myriad problems caused by successive Westminster governments' neglect of capital investment all over the country. For decades. Except for London, of course. And that was by the letters section. The Herald on the 24th of November and the voices section. Politician of the Year, Our Politicians Want Scotland to Thrive, by Catherine Salmond. Last night we hosted the Herald Scottish Politician of the Year Awards 2023. Since 1999, this event has been a key fixture in Scotland's political calendar, and it was wonderful to be able to return to Edinburgh's Preston Field House yet again in this, the 240th year of the Herald. Through the course of the evening, we looked back on another extraordinary and tumultuous 12 months in Scottish, UK and global politics, a year in which Nicola Sturgeon stepped down as First Minister, war broke out in the Middle East, Labour flexed its muscles with significant by-elections, victories north and south of the border, and inquiries began into the COVID-19 outbreak. Our main focus was, of course, at home and the chance to pause, reflect and celebrate the very best achievements of our MSPs, MPs and councillors, many of whom work tirelessly on issues that are vital for our communities, yet rarely make the front pages. These individuals embody the very essence of public service, displaying an unwavering commitment to the welfare of our communities and the prosperity of Scotland as a whole. Last night was not just a celebration of individual accomplishments, it was a collective reaffirmation of a shared commitment to a vibrant and thriving Scotland. As we applauded the efforts of our politicians, we recognised that the strength of our democracy lies in the collective power of an engaged and informed public. The importance of civic participation is crucial, and the belief that together society can forge a future that reflects the aspirations of every Scot. We are in an era largely defined by what divides us. The Constitution, gender reform, Brexit, the approach to the Middle East, and yet I believe that what unites us is far more powerful. I know every person in the room last night wants Scotland to thrive. Indeed, every Scot wants success in business, the arts and sport. We want our public services to be stronger, inequality to be tackled, and to live in a society where everyone can pursue their passion. What we often disagree about is how to get there. Last night was an opportunity to set aside those differences, remind ourselves of our shared goals, and pay tribute to those who have made a huge difference in 2023. And that was by Catherine Salmon. The Herald on the 24th of November and the Voices section. Supermarket self-checkouts, time to dump them and return to humans, by Katrina Stewart. We're not great fans of self-checkouts, said Nigel Murray, Managing Director of Booths. We pride ourselves on great customer service, and you can't do that through a robot. Amen, Nigel. Booths, a supermarket chain in the north of England, announced recently that it will bring back human cashiers and ditch self-service tills. Customers prefer it. No kidding. Self-service checkouts are one of the modern world's finest emperor's new clothes. Automated tills are one of these circular things, where a supermarket has them because every other supermarket has them. And if everyone has them, then everyone must want them. Still, without them, we wouldn't have the phrase unexpected item in the baggage area, and the various memes and comedy skits born from it. It's the only upside I can think of. I have spent some time thinking on it. But here comes Booths, the one to break the cycle. If I was to choose a particular self-service checkout to go to the wall first, it would be Sainsbury's. That recorded voice is the worst. If you've ever scanned your shopping in a Sainsbow's, you'll have heard the woman tell you, "When you're done, goodbye," which seems reasonable when you merely read it, but let me tell you the tone. It's a mix of a sarcastic disgust. This machine woman has had enough of you and your shopping. Why are you still standing there, you pathetic human with your pathetic material needs? Off to eat and sleep, are you? Sad little parcel of sinew. Good. Bye. You see, I'm anthropomorphizing the machine in a desperate bid to humanize a contact. And no wonder. We, as a species, are designed to want contact. Human interaction causes chemical reaction. Beta endorphins, the natural opiate, along with oxytocin and dopamine. We can feel pure dopamine hits from online interactions. A successful Instagram posts with lots of likes gets the neurotransmitter going. But without human-to-human interaction, we miss the beta endorphin and oxytocin. You can romanticize these things unnecessarily. The supermarket may be someone's only human exchange that day. It's simply better and more pleasant to speak to a person. But these machines serve no positive purpose. The advent of do-it-yourself furniture was supposed to herald a change in how we shop and how we live, but the DIY economy extends to overwork. When we shop, we do every task on our own. The time-saving element of self-checkouts is a fallacy. Research shows that queues are just as time-consuming in the automated logging bagging area than they are at the manned tills. Perception is a difference. Self-service feels faster because you are busy doing. In the checkout line waiting for a cashier, you are merely whiling the time away. A friend argued with me that these jobs being replaced so easily by machines are jobs that are not meaningful or interesting, and it would be better if more stimulating work was found, which shows a nice mix of snobbery and naivety. Because you might find a role unedifying or unsatisfying does not mean there is no value to it, though the notion of dignity in work is another column entirely. The number of employees has remained largely static, despite the introduction of self-checkouts, because workers are usually deployed elsewhere. The machines don't necessarily save money, because they require maintenance, which requires paying technicians, and they cost a lot in the first place. But, same as it ever was, women are most affected by any job losses caused by shopping automation. Replacement work is largely in warehouses and as delivery drivers, jobs taken by men. Sales assistants and checkout operator jobs are female dominated, and there are fewer alternatives for women. Young people too. Fears have been raised and founded over the death of the Saturday job, and ways for teenagers to begin their working careers and earn their own money. A Resolution Foundation report blamed the closure of shops and the introduction of automation, which affects jobs that are not replaced by roles suitable for young people. And of course, we must then turn to shoplifting, which is on the rise because of criminal gangs. Archie Norman, the chairman of Marks & Spencer, recently said it was too easy to say this is a cost of living problem. Of course, problems rarely have one simple solution. You cannot overlook the fact that the cost of living crisis will be compelling some people to feed themselves and their families in a way they would never have previously countenanced. Large-scale shoplifting operations are on the rise. However, as organized gangs deploy people to take specific high-value items from supermarkets that are then sold at marketplaces like corner shops or pubs, in-person service here or online using sites like Facebook Marketplace. There's another culprit, according to Mr. Norman, the middle classes. Folk who feel the service has been substandard thanks to the automated machines, and so they have no qualms about merely taking items that didn't scan properly or were difficult to scan. Perhaps there's a little thrill in doing something verboten and getting away with it, but all this coincides with the rise in automated self-checkout machines, according to the British Retail Consortium. Fewer staff are on shop floors, being deployed to back-of-shop roles, and the consequences of theft for the everyday shopper is a rise in prices to cover the cost of missing merchandise. It's not only grocery shopping. The automated machines in the post office are the main downside to the festive season. The queues, the chaos, as people trying to fathom the stamps and the labels, try to sticky tape unprepared parcels, and one overworked staff member spins around the service area trying to deal with everyone's parcels to their grandkids or their aunties. small circle of hell. So yes, self-service checkouts. No upsides, only down, like the Emperor. We are all naked, but due to our own foolishness, there's no one at the counter to sell us some clothes. And that was by Katrina Stewart.
From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 27th of November, from the news section, Brianna Gay murder trial to begin. Article by reporter Jody Harrison. Two teenagers will go on trial later accused of the murder of transgender teenager Brianna Gay. Brianna, 16, was found with fatal wounds on a path in Culcheth Linear Park near Warrington, Cheshire, shortly after 3 p.m. on Saturday, February 11th, earlier this year. A girl and a boy, both aged 15 at the time and from the local area, were arrested and charged with the murder of Brianna, a pupil at Birch Road High School, Warrington. Both defendants, now aged 16, will appear at Manchester Crown Court later on Monday for the start of their trial, expected to last between 3 and 4 weeks. Both deny murder. Neither accused can be named by court order because of their age and are identified only as Girl X from Warrington and Boy Y from Lee, Greater Manchester. Both are held in secure youth accommodation. A jury is expected to be selected later on Monday before the trial begins, before Mrs. Justice Yip. And that article was by Jody Harrison. From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 27th of November, from the news section, case study, fatal lung cancer case mistaken for chest infection. Article by health correspondent Helen McArdle. Kelsey Mackay was 20 and embarking on her career as an estate agent when her mother fell ill. A lifelong smoker, Christine Livingston was in her early 50s but was not immediately alarmed when she began experiencing sudden weight loss and a cough that persisted for more than 4 months. "Mum just thought she had a chest infection at first," said Ms. Mackay, now 31, whose backing calls for targeted lung cancer screening to be rolled out in Scotland. When her mother's condition failed to improve, she was referred to hospital for tests. In July 2012, a scan revealed a shadow on her lung, and Ms. Livingston was diagnosed with small cell lung cancer, one of the most common forms of the disease. By Christmas of 2012, following 12 weeks of treatment including chemotherapy and radiotherapy, her scan results were looking good. "We celebrated Christmas 2012 together as a family, hoping that the cancer was gone for good," said Ms. Mackay. "It took a few months for Mum to get back up to full strength, but by my 21st birthday in May 2013, Mum appeared well. We went on holiday to Marbella. I remember Mum swimming in the pool and eating well. All through cancer treatment, she said what she really wanted to relax on a beach and feel the warmth of the sun. It was a good holiday." Sadly, soon after returning from the trip, Ms. Livingston began suffering dizzy spells. A scan revealed the cancer had spread to her brain. Ms. Mackay said, "Doctors told Mum she had about 6 months to live. Mum went downhill very quickly. I helped care for her at home at first with the help of Marie Curie nurses, but Mum died in hospital. Mum always spoke about how much she'd enjoyed becoming a gran. She'd even knitted some baby clothes for me to give to my own children one day. I treasure these baby clothes, and my own children have grown up hearing all about Mum. When I think of Mum, I think of a wonderful lady who cared so much about her family. I just wish she was still here to enjoy time with us." Ms. Livingston was just 52 when she died at St. John's Hospital, West Lothian, on September the 19th, 2013. "Lung cancer screening could save lives, but it has come too late for my mum. The earlier cancer is detected, the more successful the outcome is likely to be. I wish things could have turned out differently for my family. Mum was my best friend and I miss her every day." Ms. Mackay is now a mother of two herself, the 7-year-old daughter Freya and son Rio, 5, added that she is determined to break the cycle of tobacco harm. She said, "I wish we'd had more time, more years, more chances to make memories with my mum. But, Looking back, Mum grew up in a Scotland where so many people smoked. Mum smoked around 40 cigarettes a day. And her old mum was also a heavy smoker, dying from a smoking-related illness. My duty to my children is to help break that cycle so they can look ahead to a healthy future. More needs to be done to end the damage tobacco causes. But I think if the Scottish Government introduced targeted lung cancer screening right now, it would be of benefit to people in my mum's generation. And that article was by Helen McArdle. From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 27th of November, from the news section, exclusive, Glasgow Heart Failure Breakthrough Welcomed by Patients, by Caroline Wilson. A device and drug combination tested on patients in Glasgow has the potential to revolutionise heart failure treatment, experts say. Heart failure is a condition where the heart does not pump blood around the body as efficiently as it should, and can be caused by coronary artery disease, type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure. It causes shortness of breath and cannot usually be cured, but the symptoms can often be controlled for many years. The current treatment is diuretic tablets, or water tablets, which make patients pass more urine. However, if there is a lot of swelling and fluid build up in the body, the tablets are less effective and patients may be required to go into hospital. In the UK, heart failure accounts for 180,000 annual NHS inpatient bed days. Currently, patients admitted to hospital with fluid overload require on average around 10 days of treatment with furosemide. A newly developed heart failure device and medication combination could change this, allowing patients to receive treatment from the comfort of their own home. The device was developed by SQ Innovation Inc. and tested by the University of Glasgow Heart Failure Clinical Trial Team as part of two landmark patient studies. They investigated a new skin-friendly preparation of furosemide designed to be administered under the skin, subcutaneously, by patients themselves, in their own home. The first study assessed how effective this new version of furosemide was and showed the new drug was observed as well as traditional treatment with minimal side effects. The second patient trial looked at treatment with the new skin-friendly furosemide in patients in hospital, delivered by an innovative mini pump. The pump is fitted with a small needle, which delivers the new drug under the patient's skin to help reduce fluid build-up. A large-scale study is now planned, in which patients admitted to the hospital with excess or fluid are offered the new medication and pump for use at home. Alexander Miller, 66, from King's Park, Glasgow, was diagnosed with heart failure in July 2021 and tested the device in hospital. He said, "It was no problem at all. Unobtrusively attached to my body, it allowed me freedom to do what I wanted to do, with no restrictions and was more controllable than regular medication. It wasn't painful in any way, and after it, the device was attached, I wasn't aware of it. I've lost 2.5 stone in fluid, and it worked well in comparison to the normal medication. I can see how it would give patients more freedom to do other things and manage their day better." Dr. Joanna Osmanska, Clinical Research Fellow, was involved in treating the patients with a new device, a new drug, said, "This is a big step forward in our mission to improve life for patients with heart failure, and this study demonstrates how effective this treatment method can be." Dr. Ross Campbell, clinical researcher at the University of Glasgow and principal investigation officer at Queen Elizabeth University Hospital, Glasgow, where the trial was conducted, said, "The study results allow us to progress to the next phase of the research programme, enabling us to treat patients with heart failure in their own home. The results of both trials are published together in the European Heart Journal, Cardiovascular Pharmacotherapy." And that article was an exclusive by Caroline Wilson.
This is from the Herald Scotland on Monday, the 27th of November, 2023, from Voices section. The Herald Diary. Oh no, computer. Article by Lauren Jackson. Barry Crawford spotted this sign on a van in Hamilton. He thought it was a great deal, Then he studied the small print. He thought the sign read free beer, only to notice that the free from free Wi-Fi and beer from great beer were both in bold. There's much discussion in the media about the spectacular advances in artificial intelligence, AI. Optimists believe this will be a boon for humanity, with computers using their advanced methods of calculation to help us live more productive lives. Pessimists, meanwhile, claim the smarty-pants computers will use their immense brain power to take over the planet, turning humans into their cowering slaves. Diary correspondent Mike Atkinson has a far more important point to make about the new technology. Is the Scottish version of AI called Ochai? He wonders. Brooding is best. Outraged reader Jane Gibson says, people who don't know the meaning of the word introspective need to take a long, hard look at themselves. Dead again. Cruel and heartless diary readers are figuring out the best way to murder houseflies. So far, they've suggested squirting the poor blighters with Febreze, which may not kill them, though it ensures they smell ravishing, and hiring a professional assassin to bump him off. Robert King says, surely the best method is to leave a copy of the collected works of Jean-Paul Sartre lying around the house. Settling down to peruse the existential philosophy, the fly will soon be overcome by ennui and tortured by the absurdity of existence. Finding no genuine purpose to its life, it will inevitably fall into a coma and die. The diary thinks this is a foolish suggestion, for a housefly is a weak little beastie and would struggle to flip the pages of a philosophical tome. On the other hand, maybe it could be enticed into listening to the audiobook. Bog-awful images. Toilet humour. Morag Thompson was shopping with her husband in Edinburgh when they decided to take a break in a cafe. Morag's hubby visited the loo and returned immediately, sheepishly explaining that he was bamboozled by the men and women signs on the toilet doors and couldn't figure out which cubicle to enter. You have to be an Egyptologist to use these toilets, he sighed. Preferably one specialising in hieroglyphics. Party pooper. Community-minded Nigel Wilkins once went canvassing for a political party in Paisley. The man who answered one door grinned wolfishly at Nigel, then said, I'm not saying I hate your party. It's just that I prefer rats, crocodiles and rattlesnakes. Bad language. Confused reader Don Smith says, I've heard it said that sticks and stones will break your bones, but names will never hurt you. But what happened if you fall into a printing press? That article was by Lorne Jackson. This is from the Herald Scotland on Monday, the 27th of November, 2023. From Voices section. The pandas at Edinburgh Zoo. Did we do the right thing? Article by Mark Smith, feature writer. Alex Salmond has more important things on his mind just now, obviously, but I wonder how often he thinks of the old days when he was First Minister and the SNP was in the ascendancy, and he could joke that there were more pandas in Scotland than Tory MPs. It was a decent gag, somewhat spoiled by the 2017 election. But with pandas in Scotland about to be reduced to zero, maybe it won't be too long before we're making the old panda-Tory comparison once more. But how do we actually feel about the pandas? Did you approve of them being taken from China to Edinburgh? Did you buy into the idea that their presence in Scotland would help the efforts to conserve and protect pandas in the wild? How do you feel about animals in captivity generally? And how do you feel about the pandas being sent back to China? Did you see them? I did. And I must say Tian Tian and Yang Guang were delightful, like big puffed up slow motion toddlers. But always, always, the nagging question, is this right? It's a good time to be asking these sorts of questions because there's only 4 days left now to see the pandas at Edinburgh Zoo. But the answers aren't easy. I spoke to Alison McLean, the keeper in charge of the bears, and like I do whenever I speak to zookeepers, I was impressed with her commitment and love. Love's the right word, I'm sure. Ms. McLean talked about the conservation angle, and told me a lot of the work done with the Edinburgh pandas helps research in the wild. Everything is done for the home species, she said, and that's where our contribution is as well. I also remember speaking to two remarkable men from Uganda, Gerasomo Muamuza and Mundi Gideon, who work in the Madongo Forest protecting the wild chimpanzees who live there. Edinburgh Zoo funds their field station, and the men told me about the work they were doing to reduce the impact of snares. Delightfully, they also told me what observing chimps up close is really like, and about particular individuals, like Zig and Squibs. Chimpanzees are 98.5% similar to humans, said Gerasomo. So what they do, we do. However, even Gerasomo and Mundi admitted there are compromises to be made in the link between zoos and conservation, because the conditions in which Edinburgh's chimps live are not, and cannot, be the same as the conditions in which chimps live in the wild. The question then is to what extent, if at all, keeping some animals in captivity is worth it, because of the positive effect on conservation and the protection of endangered species in the wild. Let me have a stab at answering it. The first thing to say is that, ideally, zoos would not exist at all. I was at Jersey Zoo recently, and its founder, Gerald Durrell, once said that he would tell people his greatest ambition was to shut his zoo down. What he meant was he dreamed of a day when there were no endangered species, and there would be no need to keep them in captivity. And from the start, conservation was at the heart of Jersey Zoo, so he really meant what he said. We also know we're a very long way indeed from the ideal day Durrell dreamed about, and so we need to ask how we can best help endangered species, and the research and breeding in zoos plays a part in that. When I was at Jersey, I watched a beautiful, ponderous ploughshare tortoise make his way round his enclosure. Would I prefer him to be in the wild? Yes. But the ploughshare is only found in a tiny area of Madagascar, and hundreds of them have been released into the wild from the captive population kept by Jersey Zoo. There are a lot of other examples of animals that have been saved from extinction by zoos, my favourite being Pear David's deer, which was once widespread in China but was hunted to oblivion. Fortunately, there was a small group in captivity in the UK, and it was from that population that the animal was reintroduced into the wild. Durrell himself looked after some of the young ones at Whipsnade Zoo and called them animal refugees, dependent for their existence on a handful of human beings. Of course, the work zoos do for endangered species creates a tension between conservation and commercialism. The zoos need to raise money for their work, and that means selling tickets. And selling tickets to the public isn't necessarily the model you'd design to raise money for conservation. Jersey Zoo itself is aware of this tension, and there have been ructions recently among some of the staff about whether the zoo is focusing too much on species that aren't endangered, but pull in the punters, such as aardvarks or even Guernsey goats. This is not an easy tension to resolve, and I think a lot of us, like Durrell, would dream of a day when zoos weren't necessary. Whenever I go to one, and I felt it when I saw Tian Tian and Yang Guang and the chimps at Edinburgh, I'm aware of two things, awe and delight at the natural world, and also a kind of gnawing guilt that the animals aren't free. But then I try a bit of amateur philosophy and remind myself that even in the wild, animals are restricted to certain territories by predators and a need for food and water, and that humans as well are confined by all sorts of things, job, money, status, whatever. It's the old question, isn't it? And it applies to all species. What is freedom? It means surely that the farewell we offer Tian Tian and Yang Guang is bittersweet. I wish pandas weren't at risk in the wild. I wish conservation work wasn't necessary to help them. I wish there were better ways to protect endangered species than keeping some in captivity and putting them on show to snotty kids munching crisps on a bank holiday Monday. But we've got to be realistic about what the human species has done to thousands of other species and do what we can to put it right. And that involves compromises and solutions which aren't entirely perfect. and so I will continue to support zoos as long as they put conservation at the heart of what they do. David Field, the boss of Edinburgh Zoo, said the other day that Tian Tian and Yang Guang had had an incredible impact on the natural world by inspiring people to care about nature in a world in which more than a million species are at risk of extinction, and I think and hope he's right. He also said that the outlook for giant pandas in the wild has improved, and it gives us hope for the future. It really does. But it's still grim out there, isn't it? Gerald Durrell said he hoped that one day zoos would no longer be necessary, but I suspect he knew, deep down, that such a day was never, ever likely to dawn. That article was by Mark Smith.
The Herald on the 28th of November, and the news section. Rangers and Dundee fans earned urge to make food bank donations, by Gabriel Mackay. Rangers and Dundee fans are being urged to bring donations for local food banks ahead of their fixture at Ibrox on December 9. GIS Food Banks, an association with fans supporting Food Banks Scotland, hold frequent collections outside Ibrox subway stop. This time, however, they have teamed up with the Rangers Charity Foundation and will be collecting outside the Rangers megastore inside the environs of Ibrox. Fans of both teams are encouraged to donate if they can, with items commonly in demand at food banks including canned goods, pasta, baby food and toiletries. Fans Supporting Food Banks was founded by supporters of Liverpool and Everton in 2015, and the donation drive has taken off in Scotland. Other supporters of organised collections include Partick Thistle, Kilmarnock, Dundee United, Dundee, Brechin and Motherwell. FSFS said, "We want to unite supporters of every single club in Scotland. No matter how big or small, the supporter base is there, is a place for all supporters of football to get involved in FSFS. We want to show how inclusive, powerful and community-focused that football fans in Scotland can be when we stand together to tackle issues like poverty. This isn't about party politics or one football club or another. It's about showing the difference that fan activism can make and football fans standing in solidarity with one another to support food banks during a cost-of-living crisis." And that was by Gabriel Mackay. The Herald on the 28th of November, and the news section. Rents in Scotland soar by up to 22% despite ScotGov rent freeze, by Martin Williams. The average private sector rent across Scotland has soared by up to 22% in a year, despite bill curbs brought in by the Scottish Government to support people through the cost of living crisis. The official figures for the year to September 2023, based predominantly on advertised rents, put the average rent up for a two-bedroom in Scotland at £841, up £105 compared with the previous year. Average rents for a two-bedroom property in Scotland, the most common size of property in the private rented sector, rose by 14.1%. Glasgow saw the highest rent increase of any area, both over the past year and the past 13 years. The average rent for a two-bedroom property in Glasgow soared by 22.3% in the year up to September. The average rent for such a house now costs £1,050 a month, up from £858 in 2022 and £564 in 2010. That represents an 86.2% rise in 13 years. Details of the rent hikes have come despite the then First Minister Nicola Sturgeon announcing a rent freeze in September last year to beat the cost of living crisis. Rent increase notices between September 6 last year and March 31, 2023 was seen as void. It was replaced by a 3% rent cap for private tenancies only in April, which was to remain in place till September 30, 2023. A further 6-month extension was agreed by ministers, meaning landlords with properties within Scotland will continue to face restrictions to rent rises until March 2024. Lothian had the highest average monthly two-bed rent at £1,192, while Dumfries and Galloway had the lowest, £487. Scottish Conservatives Shadow Cabinet Secretary for Social Security, Housing and Inequalities, Miles Briggs, said This is the entirely predictable result of the SNP Green government's imposition of a rent cap and their long-standing failure to tackle the shortage of housing stock. If landlords are prevented from raising rent gradually in line with inflation, it's inevitable that there will be eye-watering jumps of this kind. Rises of 14% are sure to mean that people will be priced out of areas like Lothian and Glasgow, with terrible implications for the wider economy. It's clear this policy has, as many people warned it would be, totally counterproductive, and it should be dropped as soon as possible. But Tenants' Rights Minister Patrick Harvey said the Scottish Government will forge ahead with the introduction of long-term rent controls before the end of the current Parliament. He said these statistics show how rents charged by private landlords in Scotland have been rising for more than a decade, and they are yet more evidence of the importance of action to make rents more affordable. After Glasgow, Lothian had the biggest annual rent rise at 18.4%. That was followed by Argyll and Bute, 18.2%, West Dunbartonshire, 17.2%, Renfrewshire and Inverclyde, 16.7%, East Dunbartonshire, 15%, Dundee and Angus, 15%, Scottish Borders, 11.5%, North Lanarkshire, 11%, the Ayrshires, 10.7%, and South Lanarkshire, 9.6%. The lowest increases were in Dumfries and Galloway, 1.5%, West Lothian, 2.3%, Perth and Kinross, 2.8%, and Highlands and Islands, 3%. Mr. Harvey said there is no one solution to addressing rent affordability, and our work to introduce long-term rent controls as part of the next housing bill is one measure being taken forward. This is alongside increasing the supply of affordable housing and our successful action to press the UK government to increase local housing allowance rates announced last week. Our temporary emergency legislation in response to the cost of living crisis has also provided tenants with much needed stability at a time when rents have been increasing across the UK. This includes a 3% rent cap in most cases and a temporary pause in the enforcement of evictions. Only in Scotland have tenants had this protection during a tenancy. This rent cap applies only within existing tenancies, so is not reflected in these statistics, which are based on newly advertised rents. Scottish Liberal Democrat leader Alex Cole-Hamilton said households are seeing a greater and greater proportion of their income eaten up by rent. A lack of availability, skyrocketing prices and poor quality housing are all playing a part in making life miserable for far too many. Scotland needs to build more homes of every kind and re-establish social renting as a viable option. And that was by Martin Williams. The Herald on the 28th of November, and the news section. Scotland Whisky, Glen Achy on Drive to Slash Energy Use by Scott Wright. The Glen Achy distillery has declared it will invest in technology to reduce energy demand on its Speyside site by 50% after securing a substantial grant. The distillery, which is owned by Scotch whisky veteran Billy Walker, said the reduction would come through the proposed implementation of technology known as mechanical vapour recompression, MVR. This will allow the distillery to capture low-grade waste from the stillhouse, otherwise lost to the environment, and reroute it back into the stills. Glen Achy said it currently consumes an amount of energy which is average for the Scotch whisky industry, with around 70% used to power its four-pot stills. It noted that reducing waste energy would decrease its carbon footprint significantly. The distillery is progressing the investment in the new technology after securing a grant from the Scottish Industrial Energy Transformation Fund. The project will require energy from SSE to upgrade the local infrastructure and install a larger transformer to enable the technology to be integrated. Glen Achy said the upgrade will the distillery to progressively move away from using natural gas to eco-friendly electricity and alternative green energy sources, including biogas, which is already produced from the distillery's coal products, and hydrogen when commercially available. More than 130 solar panels will be installed by Glen Achy in a neighbouring field to provide renewable power to the MVR technology. Distillery is also working with Highlands and Islands Enterprise to modify its existing boiler, improving its controls and efficiency. Richard Beattie, Operations Director at Glenallachie, said, "We're thrilled at the news of our successful grant application for a project that will help us as an SME to significantly boost our sustainability credentials. We are acutely aware of the climate crisis and strive to punch above our weight within the Scottish whisky industry to decarbonise our process. Green technology tends to be very expensive during the initial phases of development. It can therefore often prevent smaller independent firms from installing the equipment required to achieve their green ambitions. This cash injection from the SIETF, backed by the Scottish Government, is vital to facilitate such a move. We are pleased not only to receive the grant, but also the significant support from Briggs & Burton, who, over recent years, have provided guidance on MVR projects and are now taking this technology to the next level. The new investment comes shortly after Glenallachie upgraded the distillery's visitor centre with the addition of a new bar and tasting lounge. New electric vehicle charging points, now powered by solar energy, were introduced for customer use earlier this year." And that was by Scott Wright. The Herald on the 28th of November, and the news section. Scotland weather, snow and ice weather warning for Scotland by Ginny Sanderson. Snow and ice are expected to hit Scotland with hazardous conditions from this evening. Met Office has released yellow weather warnings this week for the north of Scotland and the east coast, including Edinburgh. Some areas are expected to see up to 5 centimetres of snow, as the weather warnings start from 5 p.m. on Tuesday, November 28, and continues into Wednesday and Thursday, November 29 and 30. On Tuesday evening, a huge area including Inverness, Aberdeen, East Lothian, Skye, Lewis, Orkney and the Shetland Isles is under a yellow weather warning from 5 p.m. to 11 a.m. on Wednesday. Then on Wednesday, November 29, the warning has been extended to cover most of the east coast, including Edinburgh and Dundee. The second warning for the east coast runs from 5 p.m. on Wednesday until 11 a.m. on Thursday, November 30. The Met Office has warned of ice and snow causing hazardous conditions, which could lead to injuries from falls, icy patches on roads and pavements, and roads and railways likely to be affected, with travellers expected to face longer journey times. The National Weather Service said wintry showers will lead to ice forming on untreated surfaces during Tuesday evening and overnight into Wednesday morning. Snow will begin to accumulate, especially away from windward coasts, with 1 to 3 centimetres possible. Higher routes off northeast Scotland may see up to 5 centimetres of snow accumulate. Temperatures across Scotland could reach below zero this week as the cold weather settles in. Inverness is expected to plummet to minus 1 degrees centigrade at around 7 a.m. on Wednesday morning, while Aberdeen temperatures are set to sink to between 0 and 4 degrees. And that was by Ginny Sanderson.
That concludes this week's edition of the Herald Scotland podcast. Please remember to subscribe to our channels at Peer Review. Tell your friends about our service.